When a nation feels threatened by war, there can be a lot of pressure to toe the line in public discourse and in personal expression. And that can be especially true for people who have some connection to whoever's considered the current enemy.
Tim Scheel is a professor of philosophy at UW-Stout and is the director of the Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovations. He studied how free speech fared in Wisconsin during World War I. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to talk with you today.
Well, how would you describe the political atmosphere in Wisconsin as the U.S. entered World War I?
Well, Wisconsin was one of the states that voiced a lot of opposition to entering the war prior to U.S. entry. And a fair number of Wisconsinites continued to oppose the war after we entered.
And how were those voices of opposition or maybe dissent viewed in Wisconsin?
Well, once war was declared, they were viewed quite hostilely. Wisconsin was one of the states where there was quite a bit of both legal and extra-legal persecution of war opponents and anyone who took a pacifist position.
Well, let's start with that legal realm. So what legal means were employed against those who were seen as unpatriotic and not helping the war effort, maybe even hindering the war effort?
Well, there was a number of federal laws passed in 1917 and then the 1918 Sedition Act, worded very vaguely, generally, so that local officials had a lot of latitude in applying those. So, you know, a casual offhand remark in a bar after having a beer could wind you up in Fort Leavenworth for a year and a day. And in some cases, that actually did happen.
Wow. It sounds like there are some specific examples that you can draw on. Can you tell us about someone who did end up getting that kind of a punishment?
Sure. One of the cases that is interesting to me because it's near Menominee where I work was in Eau Claire. There was a German language newspaper, and the elderly gentleman that had run that paper for many years and served in a lot of civic roles opposed the war, and during the war made a number of criticisms of the war. He said the Food Control Act, which helped support the war, was unconstitutional. After the war, the Supreme Court agreed and said it was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. He had made comments that citizens shouldn't believe everything the government tells them, and more specific criticisms of the war, too. And for that, he actually was convicted and sentenced to a year and a day at Fort Leavenworth.
Expressions of ethnic heritage and ethnic pride are pretty common, and in at least in peacetime, they're seen as a positive in many cases. But it sounds like suddenly, if you're identified with a group that is now the enemy, things can change pretty quickly.
Yeah, quickly and dramatically. Jeff Stone has written an absolutely terrific book about how things changed during wartime throughout American history. It's called Perilous Times. He's at the University of Chicago, top-notch constitutional scholar. And in almost every wartime era, going back to, you know, the Alien Sedition Acts of 1798, you know, during war, we think debate ends. You know, we've made a decision to go to war. Now it's the time to be loyal. We need to unify as a country, and dissent is not appreciated. And obviously, the law has changed dramatically since those days, but I think that's still a very powerful mentality in the minds of a lot of people, even today.
Was the political realm totally united in supporting the war, or were there people bringing up points like this who were actually serving in public office?
Well, it was difficult. So the Attorney General under Wilson was not terribly enthusiastic about a lot of this, but wasn't really in a position to outwardly oppose it. So he had sort of warned of this was going to end up going too far, and he was absolutely right. It did end up going way too far. Wisconsin's governor at the time was not a big fan of this either, and even though the state passed laws similar to the federal laws, he only signed them with the understanding that they wouldn't be applied very actively. And I think for the most part, that was true in the way the state laws were done. So a lot of these people were prosecuted under the federal laws rather than state laws.
Timothy Scheel is a professor of philosophy at UW-Stout and is the director of the Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovations. He studied how free speech fared in Wisconsin during World War I. Tim, what do we know about how faith communities responded? Sometimes, not always, there is opposition from faith communities to acts of national aggression, whether it's defensive war or offensive war. Were there people of faith who were speaking out or trying to?
Absolutely. I mean, there was religious pacifist objections. Pacifism has never been sort of a national philosophy in the United States, so far as I can tell. It's definitely a minority view. And, you know, prior to the war, that was tolerated. But once the war began, it didn't matter if your opposition was religious or non-religious. You could be persecuted the same way. So there was a group that ended up being called the Holy Rollers that operated up in Barron County. And had a religious objections to our involvement in the war. And they were prosecuted the same as others, facing various criminal sentences for their public opposition to the war.
I want to go back to something you said where an offhanded comment, maybe after a couple beers at the local tavern, could get you in trouble and even get you prosecuted for not supporting the war. That, to me, says that they were counting on people to basically tell on their neighbors or maybe even their family members. Was there a sense of distrust of the people around you?
It was certainly true in Wisconsin that given our high German population, there was sort of special attention paid in Wisconsin to that group. And there were all these loyalty leagues of different sorts who were actively recruiting, you could almost call them spies. Infiltrators, people who really did look out for every little comment somebody else might make and report you to an authority. It might be your neighbor, it might be a family member, it might have been somebody you only very casually know.
Do you feel like there was a lot of self-censorship during World War I in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. If you were of German background, it certainly would have been in your self-interest to be careful about what you say. There were UW-Madison professors of German heritage. One of them was basically forced out. He's a professor of German language because he thought it would be clever to put a button supporting the war both on the front of his coat and on the back of his coat so they knew he supported the war both coming and going. Hmm. Well, they didn't think that was very funny, and he was forced out of his position.
Hmm. As we wrap up, Tim, do you feel like there were lessons that once Wisconsin came out on the other side of World War I that were put into practice to protect free speech going forward?
Absolutely. I think amongst free speech scholars, historians, it's widely believed that our overreaction and our extreme censorship, both through the legal process and extra-legal process, actually led to those decisions in the late 20s and early 30s where the Supreme Court incorporated the First Amendment free speech doctrine protecting citizens against state violations of their rights. And that process, of course, has continued even up to the present day. So, that's the good news that came out of the war. I think in a lot of ways we did learn a lesson, but it's a lesson we struggle with today. Free speech and what are the limits of free speech are can read about it in any newspaper or blog or many books today.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Timothy Scheel is a professor of philosophy at UW-Stout and is the director of the Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovations. He studied how free speech fared in Wisconsin during World War I.